All right, we've got four questions to answer, but maybe before we get into the questions, did anyone have any thoughts on our PlayStation conundrum?
Absolutely.
No.
No. maybe raise.
Absolutely, you should put it on.
Raise your hand if you would like to see a classic PlayStation box and all in the Tamanawa collection.
I think a person of your age is asking the wrong generation.
Well, who said no to putting it in the collection? I think it might be, we might be acquiring it.
Because could we get an example elsewhere if we needed to borrow one?
Mm.
Yeah, well, if the Technological Museum in Foxton has one, we can borrow that one.
Exactly.
And if they don't have one, we should give them this one.
Yeah.
Other than that, I thought it would look great in the staff room.
What? It's something to put your coffee cup on.
That is one option we considered. When this went to our staff development committee, we did make a list of maybe let's send an email out to some museums and say, hey, we've got this cool thing. Do you guys have one and would you want it? And depending on how that goes, that would be one option that we might go down if no one else has got it.
But if you look, for example, in your collection today, I was down there with my grandson, you've got your telephones.
We do.
So if you say no to that, and maybe even the Nintendo or the Game Boy, you're kind of missing out on a huge range of some things that are continually developing, just like the telephone.
But that raises the question of, just because we have something already, is this an area of the collection that we want to continue developing forever and ever and ever?
Why not? That's why you've got the masters.
The telephones is a really good example, because our collection sort of covers roughly 1900 to 2007. And if we were offered a cell phone from 2008 today, we would seriously be having a discussion. Is a telephone collection something that we want Tamanawa to be known for or to specialise in? Or is somewhere like Motat in Auckland the best place to have that sort of specialty collection? And the same might be true of our PlayStation.
Given your space, do you have to concentrate specifically on Manoa 2? Or can you have, like, you're talking about more general things that are relevant?
Cindy, do you want to sort of give a rundown of our collecting area? Because you probably know it, the geographic area, because you know it more than I do. We've got some geographic boundaries.
We do have geographic boundaries, and they are Manoa 2, Horowhenua, because of the fact that there is no other regional professional museum within those boundaries, and we do acknowledge the fact that people commute across from Woodville, Pāhiatua, Bulls area, and so we slither a little in terms of local government that way.
We are primarily...
But yes, we have had that discussion about whether or not we should be collecting steps in technology.
Yeah, the question for you is, if you don't have provenance... Mm-hmm. You don't have provenance on the PlayStation. If you knew it was used in the manner of two, it would be equivalent to the Korea at using the Paku toys, wouldn't it?
Yep. That use. That's a relevant point for a lot of the mass-produced objects in the collection. Many of them came from overseas, but because they were used heavily in the manawa too, we can therefore demonstrate that they had an important place in the way of life.
Yeah.
So you could say as used in the staff room at Te Manawa.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're taking less objects in now, but what we're aiming to do is people give things to the museum because of memories behind them often. And so what we're trying to do is, if we take in fewer objects, we're taking in greater context. So we're trying to take in objects in which people can put them into what age, what stories they remember about using them, why it was important to them, so that you can really get a feel for its social significance and its historic significance. So fewer objects, but much greater story seeking behind it.
Yep.
impacted.
Oh, and there was another question up back as well.
If you decided not to, there's a stunning collection in Foxton in the Navy Museum that would probably break their necks to get their hands on it.
Yeah, Mavtech.
It's a truly amazing collection down there, and that may be more appropriate down there.
Yeah, exactly. Was there anyone else who thought we shouldn't collect it, who had some strong views that they would be willing to share? We're leaning towards the guests. Right, well, maybe we should move on to our written questions. Thank you, everyone, for that. It's interesting that you're all sort of raising the same sorts of questions that we're sort of we're having in our meeting rooms and not yet solving.
So I thought I'd answer the first question, which was, do we have many donations from local Māori? Not in the past. Some of the more treasured items have actually come in from Pākehā, who have been gifted these by local Māori. There's not a lot of material culture from this area that isn't archaeological. Rangitāne sort of Christianised fairly early on, and there's not a lot of what you could call traditional carvings or the like. Following on from that, there's also the aspect of what's called the Protected Objects Act 2008. So this handles what they call Taonga Te Tūru, which is Māori treasures, particularly that are found as archaeological, and roughly once every 18 months, an Aotearoa or a toki turns up. I always dread a Māori canoe coming out of someone's swamp land. Under the Act, they're required to contact the local museum and have it registered there. And generally, it was also required to be lodged with the local museum until the point at which, previously prior to this Act, those items then belonged to the Crown. Post this Protected Objects Act, the Crown now advertises to what they feel are the relevant iwi in the area, who are then permitted to put a claim in to take these taonga as their own. Having said that, if they uplift them, they may also choose to return them back and lodge them on deposit with us on loan. So the latest thing I have is it's becoming more and more likely that Māori material is probably going to go back and stay back with the communities, the iwi they come from. And so the latest thing is what they call 022NL, which is the acronym they're using for the Otaki to North Levin Expressway. And the archaeologist there for this project has said that if any Māori material turns up, it is to go to a storage area that the iwi have organised, and they will make their decisions about what happens thereafter. So that, I feel, is probably becoming the way in which the world will be moving.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask a supplementary
one?
Yes.
I was very interested, being a relative newcomer, only being here 7 years, is the statue of Te Awe Awe in the square there. My question was, I did a little bit of investigation about him, and there's quite a bit of online about him, that he was given a sword by Queen Victoria.
Yes, that's indeed the sword.
So I gave a bit more thing, knowing one of the people who are on the marae there.
I've never seen that sword.
No. He made it through inquiries, and it's somewhere in the Te Awe Awe family, but no one seems to know who. So this particular Mick Maru, who lives on the marae, he was married into a Te Awe Awe, but he was married into a Awe, which doesn't make him a Te Awe Awe. Never did some of the Te Awe Awes, but he made inquiries for me. I said, just to see it. So I had my great-grandfather's cavalry sword, see what sort of cavalry sword it was. But the answer sort of came back, yes, it's here somewhere, but no one quite knows where. And it would seem to be a great pity. That's a real treasure of the, you know, not just the marriage of the whole area there, but something of that could just go missing, or someone could decide they're short of money and sell it off or whatever.
That has happened with a collection that has come to us. Someone financed their trip to Australia, moved to Australia that way. Not without probably being severely, you know, how it is with families.
And that's one of the sorts of challenges that proactive collecting sort of inadvertently seeks to solve. There are lots of not just families, but community groups, church groups, spiritual groups and clubs and things that have their own collections. And often it's only really one or two people that are caring for them, and to everyone else it's a little bit of a mystery. Often those collections are kept because they're seen as the best place for it. Whereas if we had those relationships with various different communities and families, once those people who are looking after the objects pass on or are no longer able to care for them, it might be a logical conclusion that they come into the museum. But particularly with migrant groups and marginalised communities, the museum isn't seen as a space for them, nor is it perceived that what's special to that group is necessarily suitable for a museum. And that, I think, is an ongoing barrier that is partly our responsibility to try to solve, because you're right, something that's a family heirloom can have really great importance to a whole region. But how do you communicate that to people? You can't just say, hey, we really want that.
One of the things we face with Maori material is that there's a sense of multiple ownership.
Mm.
And we call it kaitiaki, you know, guardianship. The material lives physically with someone but is deemed to be a tribal taonga.
The sword is the same, it belongs to the Te Awa family. Mm.
And so sometimes these items come into us as a sort of safe haven in which we become the people who care physically for it. But
and often in those sorts of family cases, not just with Māori as well, it's one person that's looking after the object. But when that person makes a decision about its future, suddenly everyone else wants to be involved in
that. Yes, definitely the same thing happens with Pākehā families as well. There is material that someone's just caring for on behalf.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a small collection stolen from the museum in the early 90s. Is anything being done to try to recover that material?
It was 1981.
81? Was it 81?
Yeah, Greenstone and the like. Well, they did the best they could. We were given to understand from someone who rang up that it might have been taken to Australia. The moment you claim on it in terms of insurance, the insurance company becomes the owner if it's ever recovered. And so the choice was made by that Maori community that they didn't wish to make that claim.
All right, we've got another question. If something is rare, how is it representative of the past? I'm trying to think of an example of what that might be. If something is rare, if there's only one example of it, is the person who asked that question able to maybe contextualise what it was they were thinking of? If something is rare, how is it representative of the past?
I don't know who wrote it, but when you put up the Pāku thing and you said it was tested out, basically, yeah. It's a kahangaraya, we don't know, is it widely used or anything? You know, in 50 years' time, they'll say, oh, these were toys that were used back in...
You see, when we talk about rare, we normally think of it's the last surviving one of, or it was the only one ever made, and so it's special and needs to be cared for that reason. And often it's not necessarily that it is representative of the past, although it is a fragment of the past. When we talk about representation, we're often talking about that separately from rarity. So something will often either be rare or it will be representative. So the rare thing is the object of which there is only one. It might be the biggest diamond in the world or the biggest diamond owned by a Manawatū person. But something that's representative might be something like a crown lined plate. Everyone had one. It was fashionable and popular. And it tells of tastes of the time. rather than something that was highly prized or special.
So for instance, we've been told about a plastic moulding machine, which was the very first one made for Click Clack.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, of course, it's never small. Now, it's the only one. If it was an innovation, and it was at the time, and it's the only one, and should we take it even if the innovation went nowhere, or at least acknowledge that someone had thought?
Mm.
The other thing about rarity is sometimes the objects that are rare or, shall we say, controversial, are useful for highlighting where the mores and the standards and the ethics of a place or a society was at the time. So just because it's the one-off, it doesn't mean it doesn't tell you about what it is that other people thought about why it was controversial or rare or distinctive.
Mm. I'm just trying to think about other examples that are in the collection.
We have a taxidermist item, which was the Huia.
Yes.
And that's, I think I've seen one.
One of the taxidermists.
It was supposed to be the last one in the manor too.
Yeah, there's a lot of mythology.
There wouldn't be too many of them.
No, that is true. There's a lot of mythology around that, though, isn't there? There have been reported sightings since the last one seen in the Manawatu, or two, but we do have several Huia in the collection. Hopefully that answers that question. Do you want to take the next one, Cindy?
How do we undertake active collecting?
Oh, okay, maybe that's an email. How do we undertake active collecting? That is a movable feast. Lots of different ways, and we're still figuring out some of them. The first step of active collecting is really knowing what it is that we want to collect. So for the last few months, me, Cindy, other members of the curatorial team and the collections team have all been having input on assessing the collection, understanding where our strengths are and the weaknesses are, like what we addressed earlier. And essentially we've compared that with histories of the Manawatu, important families, events, developments that have happened in this region, and cross-reference them to sort of create this Venn diagram of, okay, what in our history is well represented in the collection and the stories that are being told really well, and the stories that aren't being told so thoroughly, the groups that we need to speak to in order to flesh out those stories, and the different themes that emerge from each of them. And that has resulted in basically a shopping list of all the things that we want to go out and find. And at the moment what we're looking at is every year picking two of those items from the shopping list and doing a mix of research, community engagement, creating focus groups, gathering oral histories, and then letting those discussions and research guide us toward the object so that we're starting with the themes and the stories first and foremost, rather than looking for things and then tracing the stories back.
One of the things that has been commented to us by Roma, who is one of our curators, is that if you set up a relationship with a community to do this active collecting process, you can't then assume that you can just move on and not keep that relation warm, so to speak, because you are setting up a social connection that they otherwise might feel a little bit used.
But the interesting thing is that a lot of what we're doing now is what one of our early directors, Myna McKenzie, talked a lot about doing. She used that phrase, not just keeping the taonga warm, keeping the objects sort of cloaked in stories and in touch with their communities, but also keeping those relationships held really closely and nurtured. And so we're, in many ways, going back to the way that the ways of operating the museum that were sort of part of the early vision when it first started, and building on relationships and stories.
So what is the community engagement with the museum?
At the moment, not a lot. So next year, probably, I'll be looking at starting focus groups based on those sort of two items from the shopping list. And initially we are going to be looking at migrant stories and migration stories. So it's really a case of reaching out to established community groups first and foremost, and people who already have engagement with the museum and leveraging existing sort of networks and building outwards.
Working towards an exhibition? Question mark?
One day. That's the thing with collecting as well. Sometimes people, for instance, that's actually one example is our COVID collection. As a very specific way of active collecting, we put a public call out just simply via social media and the newspaper saying, fill out a form, offer objects to the museum that you think are important in relation to COVID-19. And so that's one way that we have done some active collecting, but what came out of that was that a lot of people who offered objects expected that as soon as the object was offered, it would be put on display. But those are quite separate aspects of the museum. Often what comes into the collection while we intend for it to go on display possibly won't make it to the floor for several years. But in the interim, ideally, there's always research and conversation going on around that.
Do you have a publicly available catalogue, or do you have any catalogue at all?
Yes. Do you want to address that with collections online, Cindy, and maybe talk about?
We have been working to have our collections available online, so by going to the Tamanawa website, I believe, going down to collections. We have picked off sections of the collection, so probably about 10% is on, but it's clearly sort of grouped so that you can see that we've put on all our art collection, our military collection, it's not large, our Pacifica collection, and we're working to get, I'm working currently to get our women's clothing collection on. Māori material, we have to consider permissions and things like intellectual property rights before we can do that. So as I said, we've got about 10% on, but everything we've got on at least has a photo, so you can see what it is. That's the most frustrating thing with some of the ones I go into, where you just have lots of blank boxes.
And everything that's on display at the moment is on collections online, isn't it? Or just about?
I think it might be, but couldn't ask that one. Okay. People at least note that it is.
Yeah, look, you have blog posts relating to the children's
yes,
collection.
Sorry. Indeed, we do have the museum, the Tamanawa Museum Society has been specialising in childhood and has been collecting compiling a collection of blog posts about various aspects of childhood, from Meccano to different sorts of toys and Groucho Marx glasses from our items in the collection.
Yeah. Well, one more question, if I can ask. Years ago, the Robert family offered us a 19th century embroidery machine, I think. Has any movement ever developed on taking that into the collection?
They had a person come across from Switzerland, and the rest, I'm afraid, went to the scrap. You have to think it was 6 foot by 6 foot by 6 foot. And as it was cast iron, I think that we probably would have been quite challenged to find a place for it. So, yeah, sometimes you're just caught by space and capacity problems.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think with some of those things, I mean, with some of those really big items of machinery, often it's not necessarily the machinery that is the most important part, it's the knowledge of how to use it and what it was used for. And I think we're sort of collectively sort of beginning to appreciate that recording that information through things like oral histories might be a way, and accompanying photograph and other documentary evidence might be a way of capturing that sort of heritage without filling Pitt Street store with 6 foot by 6 foot devices. There was one more question.
Which of these would you collect?
Which of these would be most desirable for the museum, and how would you decide?
Would it be?
A desk from a pioneer period schoolroom is called for by the museum on display. The two options are a very typical desk, pupils sat in at a school in the district, or a less typical one, but it has the initials of a famous All Black carved into the top. But was it an All Black who went to the school in the district? Is the desk from the district the remarkable desk?
He would be one of 1,500 All Blacks now. How maybe, famous does famous have to be?
Maybe the Rugby Museum would want the second one. And we might take the first and perhaps install it in our host schoolhouse. Yeah. That's a very good question. Does anyone in the audience have a preference as to what they would want to see in the museum? The typical desk or the one with the All Black scratchings into it?
There is a new pioneering schoolroom just been installed at the Transport Museum there in Fielding. And they are calling for desks, particularly a teacher's one, if anyone knows where they can get their hands on one for that little room. Not very big, but it's a sole charge. Early, probably 1880, it's been
which
shifted
is
there.
Why we probably need to have a little bit more liaison between, because what we may not take, someone else may be interested in.
Yeah.
Oh,
yep,
how much cubic meter wise, how much of your collection is in storage compared to how much is on display?
I had to do this once for a insurance, I think, and roughly it's about 3 to 5% is on display at any one time. You have to build into that the fact that some things don't like long exposure to light, so you can't put clothing or watercolours out, for instance. And I do point out to people that we do loan, as we loan in, we loan out to other institutions too. So there's a little bit of that, but not a lot.
We do also have objects in the collection that simply aren't suitable for display. So some objects might have been collected for research purposes, where they might be visited by, for instance, the likes of the Museum Society to come and study, but because of their fragility, possibly couldn't go on display.
Another one is the, you think about prominence of an object. Are you using oral recordings as well? So, I come in with some particular item that was relevant to a local famous person. Is it just taken down in written form, or do you have some facility for oral recording?
So at the moment we don't have facilities for oral recording, although that has been done in the past, and we are likely to have those facilities in the near future. That sort of information is typically gathered at the acquisition proposal stage, i.e. you might have me assigned as the curator over this offer to the museum. I might create a transcript of that conversation, and that's certainly something that's been done in the past, and the transcript sits on our database rather than the audio itself. But certainly, I have recently done oral history training. We've got members of our communication staff who are trained to do those sorts of recordings, so that in the future that is going to be another tool that we can use, not in all cases, but where appropriate.
So some museums use audio as part of their display. You might have a handset that you can just pick up and hear some recordings. Is there much of that?
That's part of the rationale for doing some of the training around oral histories, so that we have different modes of communicating the significance of the objects, rather than just requiring everyone to read didactic text in that sort of traditional sort of museological way of experiencing the display.
Okay.
Right.
Any more questions from the floor? I'll throw in one. You did mention about at once at the old style museums where they just threw everything in, and now you have
fewer. I think there's a bit of a dispute in that you have fewer things, but sometimes the description, are you sort of guiding people too much in how to see things rather than having no guidance?
There's a woman who's done some work on that. Her name's Elaine Gurian. There is a woman who's discussed that. Her name is Elaine Gurian, and she believes people should have the opportunity to see and think about, to self-curate. But there's only so much that you can gain from seeing just whole cases full of the same sort of object.
Yeah. I mean, my personal view is that you're asking a lot of a visitor when you present to them a whole array of stuff and they really have to go hunting for the information to tell them what it's about. And that's probably reflected in the telephones display that was mentioned earlier. That was something that I curated, and deliberately it has fewer objects in it. But the interpretation is very pointed. There isn't a lot of room for interpretation sort of outside of that. And that might be something that people don't like. But the idea is that we're telling a particular story. This is the way the objects are telling the story, rather than just here's a whole lot of objects, figure it out for yourself. And there are pros and cons to both.
Okay, looks if there's no more questions from the floor, so we'll wrap up now. First of all, thank you to the two of you very much.
I think it was fascinating.
I found it so interesting, the sorts of things going on and the way you're trying to plan ahead, and it would be great to get more community involvement in that, so see what we can do with that. But certainly the museum is doing something very worthwhile for Parsonal, so we do appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you.
We have a small thank you for your effort.
And okay. thank you all for coming.